This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The Midrash says, Yofe tzichoson shel avdei batei avos mitzirosun shel bonim. The conversation of the slaves of the homes of the avos, of the fathers, is more beautiful than the Torah of the sons. Parshosoi shel Eliezer shnayim v'gimel dapin hu oim rav ashoinu. The parsha of Eliezer, the servant of Avraham, is a slave. And the whole story of what Avraham told him, and his going down to the well, and his meeting Rivka, and his going home with Rivka, and there he repeats the whole thing again, word for word to Lavan, and the Torah repeats the whole thing. The parsha of Eliezer, the Torah takes two or three pages to relate, and then repeats it. Vashevetz migufei Torah. And the sheretz, the tumor and the traithus of a sheretz, of a creepy crawly thing, is one of the principles of Torah, to halacha. Ve'en damoi metamei ki besoroi elo miribui hamikre. And how do we know that the blood of the sheretz is also metamei, that it also causes tumor? We deduce it from extra words and from all sorts of obscure limudim in the pasuk. It doesn't say it explicitly. So basic halachas, basic laws which we need to know and we need to practice, are written in the most obscure fashion so as to not to take up unnecessary wordage in the Torah, because the Torah doesn't spare words. And yet it comes to a parsha like this week's, and the story of Eliezer is told and retold without any kind of economy on words compared to the way it is in the halachic sections of the Torah. That's the observation which the Midrash makes. On a simple level, one understands it. This is our insight into the way that the Avos lived. This is the insight into the way our forefathers lived. You've got to listen to the conversation of the servants of the house. That's how you'll learn about it. The halachas are facts, and they're clear. One can learn that from very few words. But when it comes to acquiring the atmosphere of Torah, the style of Torah, and the culture of Torah, that can't be learned from economy of words. Then it's necessary to acquire a feeling, and to acquire a feeling one has to be told the whole story in some detail. One of the things that we learn from the repetition of the Parsha of Eliezer is learnt from one little word. Eliezer relates to Lavan and to Betuel, the brother and father of Rivka. What's happened to him this day? How Avraham sent him out to find a wife for Yitzchak, and how he came and he went to the well, the whole story. Bayashbi'eni adoini lemor, and my master made me swear, saying, Loisikach isho livni bibnoi saknani. You shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanim, asher anu yoshev be'atzer, among whom I dwell. In loyal base ovi telech, you must go back to my father's home, unless you've gone back to my father's house. Vel mishpachti, and to my family. Velokachto yishol livni, and from there you shall take a wife for my son. Va'yumer el adini, and I said to my master, ulai loyselech hu yisho acharoi. There are not too many suitable wives, even where you come from. What happens if I find the one and she's not prepared to go to Canaan? She's not prepared to leave her family. Vayomer alai, and he said to me, Hashem asher yisalachti lefonov yishlach malochi itoch vitzliach darkecho velokachto isho livni mimishpachta mibeis ovi. The Ribono Shel Olam, who walks before me, will send his messengers with you, and he will give hatzlocha, success to your ways, and you shall bring a wife for my son from my family and from the house of my father. That's what Avraham instructs him. The word ulai is spelt without a vov. It's spelt aleph lamed yud instead of aleph vov lamed yud. says Rashi, Eli Ketiv. The spelling is Eli. Aleph Lamed Yud spells Eli. Eli means to me. Ulai means perhaps. Perhaps she won't follow me. Eli means to me. Bas Hoy Soloy Leliezer, says Rashi. Vahoyo Mechazer Limsoy Ilosh Yemel Yavron Lifnois Elov Lasiyu Bitter. Eliezer had his own daughter, and his tongue was hanging out for Avraham to suggest that maybe his daughter should marry Yitzchak. And that's why he says Eli. But he doesn't really say Eli, he says Ulai. Except that Vov he pronounced a little bit like a Cockney. And it came out a little bit like Eli. But he meant Ulai. Omar loy Avraham, Avraham said to him, Bini Baruch. My son is blessed. Ve'ato orur, and you are cursed, because Eliezer was from the family of Ham and Canaan, who was cursed by Noach into permanent slavery. Ve'ein orur midabek bevoruch, and a cursed person cannot join together, cannot establish a union with a blessed person. So the Torah is megale. The Torah reveals here, by the spelling of the word Ulai, that subconsciously Eliezer let slip a desire that his own daughter should be invited to marry Yitzchak. And Avraham says no. There are various difficulties with this. I must tell you, in fact, that this was a rather strange week, starting from last month's Shabbos. Last Matzah Shabbos, a shiur you remember, was a difficult shiur, not difficult conceptually, but the outcome was harsh. It was a not the normal way of thinking, which didn't disturb me too much because I was satisfied that it's right. But still, it was a bit of a chiddush. And to top it all, somebody came to see me this week and he said, I hope your Matzah Shabbos shiurim are right, he says, because my life has been changing over the years to adapt to the Matzah Shabbos shiurim, and if you've made some mistake somewhere, this is going to be some horrible tragedy. That made me feel even worse. And I said to him, well, I said, each single shiur, each single word is right to the best of my ability, and where I come across later that anything is wrong, I tell you and I withdraw from it and change it. And more important, the concepts develop over the years. If you've changed your life on the basis of one Matzah Shabbos shiur, then you're crazy. But if you've changed your life over a period of years of coming to a succession of shiurim and acquiring an outlook which is developed in the shiurim, you're quite safe. And then, later on in the week, as if the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted to call me, because that worried me a lot. Michael King told me that he brought in one of the Sforim a story about my great uncle Rebbe Lilopian, who, when approached by somebody for mechila, said, no, I'm not going to give you mechila until you've learned a lot of musur and you've done a lot of tshuva. Come back in 2 weeks' time and tell me then. And the line was very much along the lines of last week's shiur. So Michael was very excited. He didn't know that I was even more excited and relieved. The excitement was, it also shows a line that one should develop an idea and afterwards find that it's my teacher's teacher's idea, it's not my own. That it's Rebbe, it's my father's Rebbe, and whom I was also zeichet to learn from. So this Shabbos, I started off with a kasha which is raised by Rabbi Avraham Yaffin. And I worked on the kasha, I didn't work on his answer, but I worked on his question. And after I finished the shiur, I decided, well, you know, last week I gave a shiur and I was worried about it, and I found it was rebellious afterwards. I'd better check up if rebellious has anything to say on the subject. And I look up, and I couldn't believe my eyes. If just about from beginning to end was my whole Matzah Shabbos shiur. Paragraph for paragraph, question, answer, chazal, just with a bit more brilliance and a bit of chazal brought in, which is terribly important, which I shall bring in this evening. So this week I can at least tell you Meirosh that I'm indebted to my great uncle Rebbe. And it's interesting, the whole Chabura, who's Rabbi Avram Yaffin, he was the son-in-law of Rabbi Yosef Zundel Horowitz, who was the Navaradok, founder of the Navaradok movement. And Rabbi Yosef Zundel Horowitz was a Talmid of the Talmidim of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. In fact, he got attached to Rabbi Yisrael Salanter very interestingly. He was a businessman and a very successful businessman, Rabbi Yosef Zundel. And the reason he was a businessman was because his father-in-law died and he had to support the widow with 7 children plus his own wife and child. He had 9 people to support him, so he ran this business. And he bumped into Rabbi Yisrael Salanter in Memo. He was there on business. Rabbi Yosef Zundel was there on business and Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was there. At that time he was living in Memo. And they talked and Rabbi Yisrael Salanter invited him to his Mesillas Yeshorim shir. And he was very moved, tremendously moved by it. And Rabbi Yisrael said to him, stay a little longer, stay another few weeks or another few days. And he said, I would love to, but I've already booked a wagon back to my hometown. I've already fixed with the Balagola and I've paid him and he's coming to fetch me and I have to go home. And Rabbi Yisrael was very upset because the two of them were getting on very well. And he said to him, when is the Balagola coming to fetch you? He said, as a matter of fact, no, I'm going to leave this minute. He said, what? He says, quickly go. He says, how can you leave the man? He's probably looking for you, waiting to take you, and expecting his fee, obviously, for taking you. And he's probably at your hotel already, and he doesn't find you. Can you imagine the tsar that he's having? Can you imagine the pain that the taxi driver is experiencing, having been called to collect you, and you're not there? It's all very well that we're having a good time, but not on the cheshbon of him, of the taxi driver. Quickly, go. And that shook Rabbi Yosef Zundel. Then he realized that the Derech HaMusar was correct. That that's the way a Jew has to live. And he, in fact, later on gave up the business and adopted a style of life which nobody was very happy with. But he did it, and he was a Godel B'Torah in his own right. He became an absolute... He closed himself up. He became an absolute hermit for a number of years. But he became a very great Godel B'Torah, and he used to rub shoulders with the Talmidim of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, who were Rabbi Yitzchak Peterburger and Rabbi Simcha Zissel. Rabbi Simcha Zissel was one of the Rabbeim of Rabbi Elyalopian. So it is not surprising that the same topic is discussed in a similar sort of, starting off from a similar approach, although they developed differently later on, both by the Navaradoka school and by Rabbi Elyalopian. The difficulty which they all discuss is firstly that in the original of the story, when Avram actually tells Eliezer to go and get a wife, where the same words are used, you shall go to Kielarti Velmoladati Telech, you shall go to my land and to my birthplace, Velokakto Ishalif Lil Yitzchak, and you shall take a wife for my son for Yitzchak. Vayomer Elov Oeved, and the servant said to him, Ula Eloi Seve O Ishal Alechas Acharai Eloret Hazuz. Perhaps the girl will not want to come with me to this land. Do you want me to agree to allow your son to go there? And here he spells the word Ulai correctly with the Vav. So what's going on? In this lies one of the important principles that we're able to learn from the repetition of the parasha. It's always bothered me. Why this lengthy word-for-word repetition of the parasha when the Torah is careful with every letter, with every full stop, every dot? A whole repetition of pages of that which we already know, there are no chidushim in it. In this one word, ulai, we find a world of chidushim, we find a world of new ideas. Firstly, the question is, why does he say elai? Why does he leave out the Vav in the repetition of the story and not in the original? Secondly, the Medrash on which this Rashi is based is in fact on the first one, on the Ulai. The Medrash says the following, Vayomer Elov Ho'eved. The Medrash does not learn from the word Ulai, the Medrash learns from the word Eved. Why doesn't it say Vayomer Elov Eliezer, and Eliezer said to Avram? Why does it call him as if disparaging is the servant, the Eved? Eliezer, after all. Says the Medrash, Hadol Dichtiv, this is what it means when it says, and the Medrash brings the most terrible posuk. Kenan beyodoy meozne mirme la shoik ohev. A posuk in Hoshea. Kenan. Which the Mephoshim take to mean traders, dishonest traders. That the word Kenan is used because the Kenanim, the Canaanites themselves, were known to be dishonest traders. Kenan, these dishonest traders, beyodoy in his hand is meozne mirma, are false scales. La shoik ohev, to oppress people he loves. That's what Hoshea says about the Kenani. Kenan, says the Midrash, Zeliezer, that Kenan which is referred to in this terrible pasuk, that Zeliezer. What did he do so terrible? Beyodo meozne mirma, what does it mean that he has false scales in his hands? Shehoyo yoyshev umashkil es bitoy ru'uyo hiyoyin ru'uyo. Because he sat and he weighed up whether his daughter was fit for Yitzchok or not. Why all this criticism? So what's so terrible? La sheik oev, la sheik oev shalilum, the Yitzchok, to oppress, his intention was to oppress the beloved one of the world, that's Yitzchok. Omar, he said, ulai lo toivo ve'etin lo izbiti, maybe she won't want to come and I will, and he will marry my daughter. Omar le ata oru ruvni boruch, Avraham said, no, you are cursed and my son is blessed, vein oru mizdabik bevoruch, it's not a good shiruch. And this Medrash goes here, it's got nothing to do with Eli. Rashi brings it on the repetition and says, here we see it expressed in Eliezer's very words. Eliezer leaves out the vav which subconsciously indicates his desire that Yitzchak should come Eli to me. So the Medrash is on the first section. Rashi brings it on the second section. The first section, Ulai, is spelt in full. The second section, Eli, Ulai, is spelt as Eli. Furthermore, who is this Eliezer? What is his stature? What right has he got to look at such shidduchim? Is he aiming too high? Gemara says in Yumadav Kapchesam Udbez, Miyemein Shalavisenu Loi Porsho Yeshiva Mehem. In all the days of our forefathers, there was never a time when there were no yeshivas. There were always Talmidei Chachomim, there were always Rosh Yeshiva. Shneimar, it says, Lech Ve'osafto Es Zikne Yisrael. Go and gather the elders of Israel. So we see there were elders. Hoyu Bamidbar, later on they were in the desert. Yeshiva Yemoyim, there was always Yeshiva. Shneimar, it says, Isfoli Shivim Ish Mizikne Yisrael. Gather to me 70 people of the elders of Israel. So we see there were elders. Elders doesn't mean old men, it means Chachomim. Avram Avinu, Avram, Zokin v'yeshiv b'yeshiva, he was learned and learning in yeshiva. Shneema v'Avram Zokin bo b'yomim, because it says Avram was Zokin. Bo b'yomim means he was old, Zokin means he was wise. Yitzchok Avinu, Zokin v'yeshiv b'yeshiva hoyo. So with Yitzchok, Shneema, as it says, v'yiki Zokin Yitzchok. Yaakov Avinu, Zokin v'yeshiv b'yeshiva hoyo. Shneema v'eina Yisrael kovdu mizokin. Avram had yeshiva, Yitzchok had yeshiva, Yaakov had yeshiva. Who do you think is next? I would think Yosef. Eliezer Eved Avraham Zokin v'Yeshiv b'Yeshiva Hoyo. Yosef is not mentioned, Moshe is not mentioned, Aaron is not mentioned. The next and the last one that's mentioned in this Chazal is Eliezer. He also learnt in Yeshiva. Shneema b'Yemer Avraham El Avdo is the Kan Beisoy, the elder of his household. That means he was the Rosh Yeshiva in Avraham's Yeshiva. In the whole household of Avraham there was nobody as senior as Eliezer. Hamoshel bechol asher loy, he who ruled over everything he had, which means Amar Rabbi Lozer, shemoshel b'toras robo, he ruled over his Rebbe's Torah. He had absolute mastery over the Torah of Avraham Avinu, a Talmid Chochem of the stature that we've probably never had since. Hamoshel b'toras robo, and who was his Rebbe? His Rebbe wasn't some little Rosh Hashiva. His Rebbe was Avraham Avinu, and he mastered the Torah of his father. Who Dameshik Eliezer? When the Torah says he's Dameshik Eliezer, what does that mean? Amar Rabbi Lozer, Shedoyle Mashki Mitirosu Shurabi La'achirim. He used to dish out his Rebbe's Torah to others. He was the teacher. So if we would have come to Avraham's home and said we want to learn, Avraham wouldn't have said, sure, sit down, I'll teach you. He would have said, well, I don't think you're quite ready for Eliezer's shiur yet. You'll have to sit here a few years. And when you've made it, you can go and listen to Eliezer's shiur. He's the Rosh Yeshiva. He was the person who taught the Torah of Avraham to the world. And the Medrash says Moshe b'chol asheloi, that he was Moshe b'yitzroi. That is exactly as Avraham, he had complete mastery over his own yetzer, over his own personality and his own drives, complete mastery. So in Torah and in Musar he was absolutely tops. Who's the Shaila? Why he suggests a shidduch between his daughter and Yitzchak? Who else? Rosh Hashiva. Who could Avraham hope to have better than that? Some little girl from Chazan, where they've never seen a Yid. There he's going to find a better girl than the Rosh Hashiva's daughter. So Eliezer suggests it by a mispronounced word. He hasn't even got he hasn't even got it within him to actually bring out such a suggestion. He's never made such a suggestion. He brings it out by a mispronounced word, and the Medrash pounces down his throat and calls him. Who is this Eliezer? Kanan beyodoy ma'uzne mir me'la sheik ohev. And Rebellion describes this. He says, do you know what this is? Ma'uzne mir me'la. It's the Kananim who take their scales and they bore out the two branches of the scale. They make them hollow. You know, the work involved there. Imagine them boring them out there at night when nobody's looking. And then they put lead into the one side, into the side where you put the weights. They put lead and they keep the other side hollow. And then they go around selling their wares on their scales. That's Eliezer. That's the man we just learnt about in Gemara Yuma. So that also doesn't make sense. What's so terrible? A further difficulty. When Eliezer comes to meet Lavan, Lavan runs out, very excited, and he says, Boy Baruch Hashem, come in, you blessed one of God. Ask the magistrates, when is Eliezer a Baruch? Eliezer is an Oru, that's why he's there where he is. So the first thing that's interesting is that the Medrash expected Lavan to recognize on his face whether he's an Oror or a Baruch. We'll have to discuss what is the meaning of a man who's cursed or a man who's blessed. But it's something which should be discernible on his face. So the two views. One says that Eliezer, that Lavan thought he was Avraham. He heard that this man had come and was talking Shidduchim about this young girl. He thought, so Eliezer, Rosh Hashiva, with a long beard. You can imagine the hadras ponim that Eliezer had. Didn't look like our concept of servants, that I assure you. He looked as he was, a great, great Rosh Hashiva, a very big Talmud Chacham. So he sees this man and runs up, thinks he's Avraham, and says, Boy Baruch Hashem. It's the one view in the Medrash. The other one is no. Omer Rabbi Yaakov B'Shem Rabbi Yochanan, to Beis Guvri. Now, Omer Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Doiso, Kanan Hu Eliezer. Kanan is actually Eliezer. That grandson of Noach, the son of Ham, who was actually given the curse, was Eliezer himself. He changed his name later. So how can they love and call him a Baruch Hashem? And because he served that tzaddik Avraham Avinu so trustworthily, Yotzo miklal oru liklal baruch. He went out of being an oru and he became a baruch. At what point was that? That was as he meets Lavan, as he's at the door. When does he change the Ulai to the Eli? After that. He's already Yotzo miklal oru. And then he changes Ulai to Eli, and then Rashi brings that he means that he's got to be that he would like the shidduch for himself, and Avraham said, no, you can't. You're an Oror and I'm a Baruch. I'm not an Oror anymore. And if he was on the verge of becoming Ois Oror, if moments later he was going to become Ois Oror, was he so far off when he originally suggested the shidduch? Didn't Avraham realize that he was on the verge of coming out of his curse? And if Avraham would just wait a little bit longer, he would be out of the curse. And again, who could be a better shidduch than Rosh Hashiva's daughter? What's it all about? In the actual relating of the story, the Torah doesn't indicate to us that he said Eli, that he subconsciously meant to me. Avraham perceives it, and the Torah perceives it. That's why the Torah says, "Vayomer Elov Ha'eved," and the slave said to him, "The Torah is made. The Torah gives evidence." But at that point, he still has the mentality of a slave. There is something in him, deep down, there's a little something, minute and almost indiscernible, which is the mentality of a slave. What is the mentality of that slave? The Medrash tells us, is ma'ozne mirme la'ashoik ohev. Dishonest scales, dishonest weights, he loves to oppress. What does it mean about Eliezer? It just doesn't fit together. What is a slave? So firstly, if we go back to the origins of this curse, the end of Noach, where Noach comes out of the ark, plants his vineyard and gets drunk. Ham and Canaan see their father and grandfather, and they in fact castrate him. Asks Rashi, Uma me ro'o Ham shesirso. What was Ham's philosophy? What was his intention in castrating his father? Amar lahem le'echov, he said to his brothers, Odom harishun shnei bonim hoyuloi. Odom harishun had two sons. V'horag ze bishvil Yerusha sa'ilu. And the one killed the other because he wanted the whole world. V'yavinu yesh le gimel bonim. And our father has three sons. And he still wants to have a fourth child. When he heard that Noach was planning to have a fourth child, which he was, Ham got very worried. Where's there place in the world for four people? See, we always think that the fear of overpopulation is a new fear. It's not. It's very old. When there were four people, there were more than four people, but this was the fourth. There were three sons and their grandchildren and the parents. There was one family in the world, right after the flood. Already they were starting to lecture and talk and write about the problems of overpopulation. So the fear of overpopulation is a midah. It's a human characteristic. It's not a scientific fact. Before the Industrial Revolution, there were tremendous fears of overpopulation. What didn't they understand? What was the chiddush of the Industrial Revolution? That with brains and resourcefulness, one man with a smaller piece of ground can now produce more than previously 10,000 people could produce. So your overpopulation has been resolved, your overpopulation problem, at least temporarily. It isn't just a question of there's so much land in England and there's so many people. And the way it is at the moment, each one's got just about enough to live. If you average it out, there's enough ground to support the people. If you're going to double the population of England will starve. And that's where you had the Malthusian theory developing. Comes the Industrial Revolution and says, no. The whole thing is turned upside down. What you thought was enough to support only X million people can support 100 X million people. What's changed? There's more land. There's more technology. That's all. And the whole thing changes. So another few hundred years go past. Well, not even a few hundred years. And again, overpopulation. Everybody's worried again. The fear of overpopulation is the symptom of a slave, of an eved. Slaves worry about overpopulation. Even in the time of Ham, worried already. How are four people going to share the world? Three people we can just about manage. Four? It's like with everything. A parent has two children, they can't imagine where's a third going to fit? Do we have time for a third? Do we have place for a third? Do we have money for a third? And the third comes and he fits in somehow. But this is it. Our hands are full. His mother holds one and father holds the other. The third one's already an orphan. A fourth one is irresponsible to bring a fourth child into the world. And some mistake happens and the fourth child comes along and he brings more nachas than all the other three children put together. And they manage fine. And everything's fine and the family's richer and more adorable and more lovely and everything's going beautifully. But five children are already impossible. It comes a fifth and a sixth and a seventh and it goes. How does it work? We always believe that we stretch to the ultimate of our resources. Otherwise we would be admitting to laziness and to selfishness. It would be against human nature for me to say I can do more than I am. So I always believe that I'm doing the most I can. If you shove some more onto my back, I'll manage that as well. Whether there is a straw that finally breaks the camel's back or not, I don't know. I never saw a straw breaking a camel's back. I never saw a camel's back broken. But they say there is a straw that breaks the camel's back in the end of it, but it's not something one has to worry about until one has to go pretty far before that final straw comes. If you would have told Ham at that time, don't be idiotic, four people in the world, what are you worried about? He would have said, you irresponsible human being, do you not care about society? Have you no thought of the future of society? Do you live only for yourself? That's how he would have preached, the same as they do today. In 50 years' time, when the world's population is double what it is today, and we're all living happily and managing, and people will look back at today and they'll say, it's ridiculous, and they worried about overpopulation. Now we've got a problem with overpopulation. Then what do they have to worry about? And 50 years later, there'll be double the number of people again, and it'll be all right. Leitohu bro lashivis yitzor. The Ribbono Shel Olam did not create the world for emptiness. He created it to be occupied. And being occupied means it should all be occupied, all of it. No Sahara deserts, no Kalahari deserts, no Karoos. There's plenty of place. People can't live there yet. That's because technology doesn't allow it yet. So we have to use our brains a bit more. The method of solving the population crisis is to develop greater technology, not to cut down people. And Adaraba, the people that you might not have because of population control are the very people who might be the brainiest and who might be able to solve the problem. So where is there no population control among the uneducated, among the people who haven't got much chance of solving the world's problems? Who are the ones who decide to practice family control and family planning? Are the ones who have got the brains to think ahead a little bit. So what are we doing? We're cutting out the brains that will solve the problems. An Eved, a slave, there are many aspects to a slave. We're oversimplifying it this evening and talking only about one aspect of a slave, but it's a very important one. It's the essential one for the shiur. A slave is a person who's unproductive. That's an Eved. An Eved is a person who doesn't understand productivity and is incapable of productivity. There's three of us. You bring a fourth one. What will he do? He'll want to eat also. What's he going to eat? I'll have to work for him. He doesn't realize that the fourth one might come and might contribute as well. As the Midrash says, and Rashi in fact brings it, he says, Ham, you stupid idiot. I want a fourth child that the youngster will look after me in my old age, so that the three of you won't be troubled with me. It's easier for a young boy to look after the old man, while you have to establish your own homes and you have to set yourself up. And afterwards, when I'm gone, you'll help him get established. But it will take the pressure off you. And you in your selfishness have stopped me having this fourth child. For that you be the slave to your brothers now, because they're going to have to look after me. He doesn't understand that the fourth child can make a contribution, not take. A slave thinks everybody takes. That's what they're there for, everybody's taking. And any additional person is going to take more from limited resources. The fact that people are resourceful, the fact that people are productive and creative, and that one man can create more than he consumes. If an Eved understood that, he wouldn't be an Eved. But that's the essence of human life, is to create more than you consume, to contribute more than you take. And if human beings are creating more than they consume, what nonsense is overpopulation? How can you have overpopulation if everybody is creating more than they're taking away? In a world where everybody's taking more than they're creating, of course you've got overpopulation. Even with four people, you've got overpopulation there, because there isn't enough bushes. If you have four people all taking more than they're making, you've got overpopulation, as we have today. The overpopulation is not a problem of geographical resources and physical resources. Overpopulation is a problem of productivity and creativity. It's people who want to take without being prepared to make the contribution. That's an Eved, that's Chaim, no fourth child, there's no place for another child. All he'll do is take and he'll give nothing. The Morris says, in Psochim Daf Kuf Yud Gimel Amud Beis, Chamisho Dvorim Tzivo Knan Es Bonov. Five things Canaan instructed his children, his future generations. The Rashbam says, why is it important to know this? Because you've got to watch out when you meet a descendant of Canaan, whom according to many this country is blessed with. You need to know what to expect. Avu Zeze. Number one, love each other. Just support each other. Number two, the Avu Es Hagezel. Torah is not racialistic, but it's realistic. Love theft. You must develop an affinity for theft. The Avu Es Hazimu. And love other people's wives. Love Zimu, there should be no family loyalties. The Sinu Es Adonaichem. And despise your masters. Ve'al tedabru emes, and don't talk the truth. That is the essence of the culture and the civilization of Knat. Support for one another, an affinity for theft for its own sake sometimes, not just for physical gain. Theft just because it's geschmack to take something when nobody's looking. Love family disloyalty, hate your masters, and don't talk the truth. That's the essence of Knat. Now Rashbam says that that becomes the assumption. Therefore, if you talk to a Knani or to a descendant of Knan and he tells you something, you must assume it's false until proved true. With most people, you can assume it's true until proved false. But with the descendants of Knan, you've got to assume that it's false. There's al tadabru emes. You've got to assume if something's missing, you've got to assume that the Knan has taken it. That's the first aspect. Not because you're racialistic, but because you understand what the Knani is. He loves Gezer. People say it's very unfair in this country. If a white man commits a rape, he gets off with 7 years in prison. And if members of other races commit a rape of a white person, they hang for it. Firstly, I don't know if that's a legally accurate observation or not. But even if it is, it doesn't shake me terribly much. By them, it's not as serious as it is by white people. A white person, when a person does a thing like that, he knows it's a serious crime, and the society knows it's a serious crime. With them, it's not a serious crime at all. One has to teach the seriousness of it. It's not serious at all. It's part of their culture. There's nothing wrong with it. They love it. They enjoy it. But what is the common denominator of all that? Avu zeze, trade unions. Avu zeze, support one another. Avu es hagezel, take what isn't yours. Avu es hazimo, disrupt family life. And al tadabru emes, don't talk the truth. All of that are the symptoms of the unproductive person. That's it. You've got to have trade unionism if you're going to be unproductive, because you want more money for doing less. The only way you can achieve more money for doing less is to blackmail your employer. In order to blackmail your employer, you've got to have an avu zeze, you've got to love one another. I, the poor employer, what about him? Sinu es adonechem, you must despise him. Have no sympathies for him. Absolute intolerance for your balabos. Avu zeze, your loyalty is to one another. I, it's dishonest, I'm taking more money for doing less work. Avu sagezel. Love theft. Zimo in the family situation is exactly the same. Undermine family life, because that's the strength of your balabos is in family life, and you undermine that. And al tadabru emes, then he'll never know where he stands with you. He always assumes that everybody's telling the truth. You always tell a lie and you'll be a step ahead of him. An eved, the essence of an eved, as we're discussing this evening, is his unproductivity. Says the Medrash, Kanan beyodoy meozne mirme, la shuik ohev. Kanan, in his hands are false scales. What is false scales? I'll give you less and you'll pay me more. So what are you paying me for? For nothing. That's an eved. I want to be paid for nothing. And that's why an eved needs a master. What's the essence of an eved? An eved is a person who's not self-motivated. A person who's self-motivated doesn't need a balabos. A person who isn't self-motivated needs a balabos. Why isn't he self-motivated? For self-motivation, you've got to realize that if I work a little harder, I get a bit more reward and I don't need a balabos. That's how capitalism works. With avodim, it's different. And everybody's there to get as much as he can without creating. So where's he going to get it from? He's got to take it from somebody else. If he doesn't have a balabos, then his balabatim and his friends are going to lose everything they've got. If you're going to leave it to them, they'll destroy you. Because they base themselves on taking that which they don't deserve, on that which they have not earned. What's it going to do with Eliezer? Eliezer sees the introduction of Rivka as a threat. What do you need to go there looking for a wife? We've got it all at home. It's all within the club here. I've got a daughter for you. What do we have to go getting somebody else? Avrom's taina is as if to say, Eliezer, I'm prepared to take a girl from far away, who's never seen a yid. All this Torah that we've been learning together for years and years, she won't know. I'm prepared to take her and to start teaching her aleph-bays. All I want is she should have good midah, she should be a nice girl. I'll teach her from the beginning, I'll teach her from scratch, word for word I'll go through it with her. I'm prepared to be productive, I'm prepared to take a nothing and to make her into a something. And you want it all laid on already? You want a shidduch for your wife? She must be ready made already. He must be ready made already. Yitzchak you want. You also go and work. Go and find a young boy and train him. Build him up. Says Avraham, in this I already notice a little bit of your slavery. There's a little bit left. You're still an Orer Eliezer. You can't marry my daughter. Had you never thought of it, had you gone along with me all the way in my idea of taking a girl from abroad, and she wouldn't have come back, then good, you could marry my daughter, because you would have shown yourself to understand the principle of getting some new blood in. It doesn't matter, it's not a threat to you. But now that you've pushed in already the Eli, maybe she'll come to me, maybe he'll come to me, maybe he'll be my son-in-law. That shows you're scared of Rivka. You're scared of something new. You're scared of productivity. The Ma'ozne Mirmo is the weighing up. When Eliezer was weighing up, what conclusion did he come to? He took his daughter and objectively, thoroughly objectively, because we find no other criticism against his daughter. Thoroughly he weighs her up, middle for middle, each characteristic, one after the other, she goes through it. Is she fit for Yitzchok in this? Is she fit for Yitzchok in this? She goes through everything. And he comes to the conclusion, yes. She's a good shidduch for him. Avraham says, no. What's happened? He was weighing up the middos, but he was using a false scale. There were stones inside, and he didn't realize it. That's the evet. There wasn't absolute emeskite. There was a little, as far as we can understand, and as far beyond our understanding, there was a little spot of blurring of the truth. One thing he forgot. One factor was not included in his scale. Now you go to the supermarkets now, and when you put stuff on a scale, it tells you straight away how much it costs. It doesn't tell you how much it weighs, just straight away how much it costs. All sorts of factors. It's a little computer. Already the scale. There are all sorts of factors which go into it so that it can give you the final answer that you want. But if one factor is missing, you'll get the wrong answer. In Eliezer's scale, one factor was missing. I'm still Knan. After all, I still have within me an element of Avdus. And Ein Klein Orur Mizdabek Bevorach. A cursed person can't join up with a blessed person. What does bracha mean? Bracha means productivity. That's what bracha means. That you should take one grain of wheat and plant it and you should reap a ton. That's bracha. What's klala? You take a ton of wheat and you plant it and you only get one grain out of it. Unproductivity. Bracha, blessing means productivity. You cannot bring an eved, you cannot bring an orur and a boruch together. The two are opposite. They work in opposite directions. An Orer wants to get as much as possible for nothing, and a Boruch wants to contribute as much as possible. And the two are pulling in opposite directions. And you, by not realizing fully that you still have a touch of Canaan in you, show yourself still to be Canaan. He comes along to Lavan, and Lavan calls in Baruch Hashem. And the Midrash says, Yotzon miklod orur voliklal baruch. He's already gone out of an orur and has become a baruch. How did he do that? Let's understand why he uses the word Eli in the repetition of the story to Lava. If he's learned his lesson and he now goes with absolute dedication to find the wife for Yitzchok, and there's no sign in him whatever of any reluctance or any secret wish that maybe she won't come, he puts all his mesirus nefesh into getting this wife for Yitzchok. Why does he say Eli? He says to Lavan, I want you to know, I wanted her for myself. I wanted her I wanted him for my daughter. Don't think I've come here looking for a shidduch because he's limping and he's a hunchback and he's not good enough for my daughter, so I'm coming to get your daughter. You should know I wanted him for my daughter. My daughter wasn't good enough. That's why I'm here. The best he could find is my daughter, and you thought I was Avraham Avinu when you saw me. That's the kind of image I have, and that's the stature I have. I'm little less than Avraham Avinu, and yet my daughter is not good enough, and yet that's why I've come to get your daughter.
What sales talk!
What unbelievable persuasive ability! Would he have? That's confidential. None of your business. I've been told to come and get a wife. That would have ruined the shidduch, and he would have gone back, and she would have married his daughter. He would have married his daughter. But he doesn't. He uses that very example. Eli, I wanted her for myself. He wouldn't take me. I'm not good enough for him. You're good enough for him. At that, we see that he's yotzo miklal ora. He's displayed completely how he's prepared to accept. Firstly, to completely annul himself to Avraham Avinu, and secondly, how he's prepared to accept the concept of productivity. It's not a threat to me. I'll find a shidduch for my daughter as well. There's not only one girl. There's not only one boy. Yitzchak's not the only boy in the world. The only thing is, one has to make another Yitzchak. One has to create a Yitzchak. You don't find them ready-made. I'm prepared to find such a boy and to make him. I'm a Rosh Yeshiva. I know how to educate. The same as Avraham is prepared to take a Rivka from Haran and to turn her into an Ein Yisrael, into a mother of Yisrael. So I'm prepared to find a young boy for my daughter and I'll turn him into a big Talmud Chochem. He's Yotzo Miklalor, and no longer does he want things ready-made and handed to him on a platter. He's now prepared to take something from scratch and to build it from nothing. At that point, Eliezer is Ois Eved. This is a concept in Avdus which is terribly important to understand, because just as it's possible to be Yotze Miklal Orur Uvo Liklal Boruch, as a man through his own efforts can emerge out of being a cursed person and can become a Boruch, although nobody gave him the Bracha, he did it himself. So it's possible, Chas V'Shalom, for a person to be Yotze Miklal Boruch and Bo Liklal Orur. A person can also become an Eved. A person who used to be a free man can become an Eved. One can do that to oneself. It's possible to deteriorate to the level of avdus. The moment a person desires to get more than he's giving, the moment a person desires to take more than he's, to receive more than he's giving, to take more than he's giving, there he's on the avdus line. Ochen oru. It's necessary to understand that the essential, one of the essential midas that Avraham was looking for was the midah of Chayrus, the midah of productivity. And it's interesting that Eliezer, in searching for Rivka, uses that very test. When I ask her for a drink, is she going to try and get away with a minimum and still then put her hand out for a tip? Or is she going to do more than could possibly be expected of her? I'm going to come with camels. One year we worked out how much water each camel drinks and how many camels he had. I don't remember how many gallons we came to, but I think we came out that if the rafts filled all their garage tanks with water and Eliezer turned up with his camels, they wouldn't have enough there to feed Eliezer's camels. It was a lot of water and they didn't have the pumps. She had to do it by hand. That's what Eliezer wanted to test. When I say I'm thirsty, please give me a bit of water, will she jump to it and give me the water and say, "V'gam v'gmal echo eshke"? I won't do any what you asked. I'll do more than you asked. I'm a contributor. I'm here to make new things, not to take. Or is she going to try and get away with a minimum and then put her hand out? And we're living in a world which is afflicted. I have this. The effect of the third world on the free world is so enormous today that we haven't even begun to feel the devastating effects of it. We often talk about how even in the Jewish world we're affected by our environment. We often talk about the effects of Christianity on Jewish thinking, on frum people. And do you think that the third world is not having an effect on the free world, and the free world in turn on Torah? There is a very strong Christian group in America who've started developing a philosophy of Christianity which is basically a dressed up form of communism. And they're presenting it no longer as a political theory, but they now present it as a religious theory. And in fact, the day after Reagan's election, he was presented, it was in this morning's newspaper, I think, with a 250 or 220 page manifesto from the Catholic Church of the need, religiously, to distribute America's wealth equally. What does distributing wealth equally mean? irrespective of what you're contributing, or what you take should be the same. Poshut Kanan, Avdus. The Christian church has become 100% dedicated to the promotion of the values of Kanan, the effect of the third world. Where are most of the adherents of that church? Today in the third world, tremendous numbers. In a city like Johannesburg, that a bishop who is a descendant of Canaan should be appointed to lead one of the most influential churches? It's weird. A man who has stood for the principles of Canaan, fought for the principles of Canaan, he's their spokesman. He's their Rav HaRoshi, he becomes the chief rabbi over here. And people hail it, wonderful, progress is being made. We're finally accepting the ethics of Canaan. Finally being understood that you've got to give a man what he wants, not what he's earned. And we're beginning, the world is beginning to accept it. The danger is it's no longer being presented as an economic theory, because it doesn't make sense economically. It's no longer being presented as a political theory, because it doesn't make sense politically. The world is sick of it already. It's taken on a new guise. Dress it up in religion. This is Christianity. And if you want support politically of the Christian church, you've got to follow Christian ethics. And Christian ethics are now becoming the ethics of Canaan. And don't think that that kind of thing doesn't have its influence in Torah. Don't think that that kind of thing doesn't penetrate through some osmotic process right into the minds and into the hearts of any person who lives in that society and isn't 100% alert for it all the time. It affects our own work ethic. Chassid Shalom, we shouldn't be affected by this economically, by this acceptance of increased pay for decreased productivity. But we should know. Otherwise it should happen that one of us should turn down a salary increase from a balabos because we feel we're doing nothing more. Why are you paying me more? What am I doing more? You want to pay me more? Give me more to do? Give me more responsibility? Otherwise we should teach such a thing. Why the Jewish people should teach such a thing. And in Torah itself as well. It's terribly important to make a contribution, not only to take. It's terribly important to see that in every area in which one finds oneself, one is giving more than one is taking. We've often talked about that in the very framework of the Beis HaMedrash. That while I don't believe that everybody who's learnt Beis can already be teaching Aleph, if you've been learning Gimel, you can be teaching Beis. I think you've at least got to know up to Yud before you start teaching Aleph. There's got to be some kind of level achieved before one starts teaching. But teaching is not the only area of contribution. A person contributes through his home. He contributes through his personality, through his character, through saying a nice word to somebody, through welcoming somebody, through physical labor, helping somebody, working with somebody, assisting the Beis HaMedrash or the family. There are all sorts of ways where one can contribute. And the question that has to be asked one all the time, when one finds oneself in a position of receiving, am I giving more than I'm receiving? That's all that's important. If I'm not giving more than I'm receiving, I'm a Kanani. It's not a Yid, that's not a Ben Avrom, that's not a Baruch. A Baruch is a person who's able to produce more than he reaps. Who's able to reap more than he's planted. The fear is that without thinking, this can become a religious thought as well within Torah as well. That I'm entitled to take. That I'm entitled to take, whether it's financially, whether it's in learning and in Torah. And that isn't so. I mentioned recently, there's a new school opening up in the area. And for certain people, I think there are benefits in supporting the new school. With children, with their children. It was suggested by one of the parents, in fact, that if there are a group of people who will be sending their children there, what about canvassing a little bit? And I said, no problem, there's nothing wrong in presenting the case to other parents, but not to the parents of children at other schools. If you want to start a new school, not on the cheshbon of other schools. If you want to be creative, create something new. Don't create something by taking away from somebody else. And it certainly isn't the intention of the school to do so, and it shouldn't be the intention of any institution to do so. If you need to take from somebody else, it's a sign that your institution is not needed. If you're starting a business and you need to take customers from somebody else, it's a sign that your business isn't needed. If you need income and you've got to rob it from somebody else, it's a sign that you are not needed and that the justification for that income is not needed. That's not so. It doesn't mean that if you're not offering a better service, that the time will come that people might leave their one place and join a second place. Okay, that's something a person is always free to do. But if you have to construct and build your business or your institution or your whatever by breaking down something else and by robbing from something else, you should know that milachatchila, that's not a teredika business and it's not a teredika institution. That cannot be done. If there's a need, the need is to contribute. The need is to create something new that wasn't there before. And so we should look at every circumstance in which we find ourselves. What can I do in this circumstance to create something here that wasn't here before? To make the world, or my community, or my shir, or my family, or my business, a better place than it would be without me. At least as much better as much as I'm getting out of it, preferably more. For if every human being will contribute more than he takes, there will never be a problem of overpopulation, and there will never be a problem of competition. And every added person into a business scene, into an educational scene, or into a family scene, every added person will add with him richness and benefit to all the others, thus making the world a better place in which to live.